The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, hour number two. Bill Donahue with you on this Mother's Day Sunday evening. Once again, happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. We're waiting to get Tommy Lasorda on the line this evening. We got Benji Molina coming up later on the show. While we're waiting for Tommy, we'll take a look at the New York Rangers. The New York Rangers at the end of the second period are leading the Washington Capitals down at the Verizon Center in Washington by a score of 2-1. And let's see, tonight is the anniversary on this date in 1973. The New York Knicks win their second NBA title with a 102-93 win in Los Angeles. That was quite memorable. The Knicks win their second championship, defeating the Los Angeles Lakers 102-93 in the fifth game of the NBA Finals. Earl Monroe led the way that night with 23 points. Bill Bradley posted 20 points, 7 rebounds, and 5 assists. That was the second and, unfortunately, the final championship for the New York Knicks back in 1973. There hasn't been one since, and doesn't look like we're going to see one very soon. In the meantime, we're going to take a look at Major League Baseball. Did you ever wonder where the 30 Major League teams got their nickname? Well, I have. We're going to take a look at where they got their nicknames. Starting with the Arizona Diamondbacks. In 1995, the expansion franchise ownership group asked fans to vote from among a list of nicknames that included Coyotes, Diamondbacks, Phoenix, Rattlers, and Scorpions. Diamondbacks, which is a type of desert rattlesnake, was the winner, sparing everyone the mind-boggling possibility of a team located in Phoenix, Arizona. Imagine called the Arizona Phoenix. That'd be kind of funny. Moving on to Atlanta. The Braves, who played in Boston and Milwaukee before moving to Atlanta in 1966, traced their nickname to the symbol of a corrupt political machine. James Gaffney, who became a president of Boston's National League franchise in 1911, was a member of Tammany Hall, the Democratic Party machine that controlled New York City politics throughout the 19th century. The Tammany name was derived from Tama Mend, a Delaware Valley Indian chief. The society adopted an Indian headdress as its emblem, and its members became known as Braves. Sports writer Leonard Coppett describes Gaffney's decision to rename the team, which had been known as the Doves, in a 1993 letter to the New York Times. Wouldn't it be neat to call the team the Braves, waving the symbol of the Democrats under the aristocratic Bostonians? It wouldn't bother the fans, and it didn't, especially after the Braves swept the Philadelphia Athletics in the 1914 World Series. Next, the Baltimore Orioles, who were up here in New York just recently playing the New York Mets and the New York Yankees. When the St. Louis Browns moved to Baltimore in 1954, the franchise was rebranded with the same nickname of the Baltimore team that dominated the old National League in the late 1890s. That team, which featured the likes of Wee Willie Keeler and John McGraw, was named after the state bird of Maryland. The orange and black colors of the male Oriole bird resembled the colors on the coat of the arms of Lord Baltimore. The Boston Red Sox. The team that became known as the Red Sox began play wearing dark blue socks, no less, as a charter member of the American League in 1901. With no official nickname, the team was referred to by a variety of monikers, including Boston's and Americans, as in American League. In 1907, Americans owner John Taylor announced that his team was adopting red as its new color after Boston's National League outfit switched to all-white uniforms. Taylor's team became known as the Red Sox, a name popularized by the Cincinnati Red Stockings from 1867 to 1870 and used by Boston's National League franchise from 1871 to 1876. The Chicago Cubs. Chicago's first professional baseball team was known as the Chicago White Stockings. When the team began to sell off its experienced players in the late 1880s, local newspapers began to refer to the club as Anson's Colts, a reference to player-manager Cap Anson's roster of youngsters. By 1890, Colts had caught on, and Chicago's team had a new nickname. When Anson left the team in 1897, the Colts became known as the Orphans, a depressing nickname if there ever was one. When Frank Seeley took over the managerial duties of Chicago's youthful roster in 1902, a local newspaper dubbed the team the Cubs, and the name stuck. Chicago White Sox. In 1900, Charles Comiskey moved the St. Paul Saints to the south side of Chicago. The team adopted the former nickname of its future rivals, the Cubs, and became the White Stockings, which was shortened to White Sox a few years after the club joined the American League in 1901. The Cincinnati Reds. The Cincinnati Red Stockings, so named because they wore red socks, were baseball's first openly all-professional team. In 1882, Cincinnati's entry into the newly formed American Association took the same name and retained it after moving to the National League in 1890. Red Stockings eventually became Red Legs, and the Red Legs was shortened to Reds. Before the 1953 season, club officials announced that the team would once again officially be known as the Cincinnati Red Legs. Around the same time, the team temporarily removed Reds from its uniform. The AP reported in 1953 the political significance of the word Reds these days and its effect on the change was not discussed by management. Cleveland Indians. Cleveland's baseball team was originally nicknamed the Naps after star player manager Napoleon Lajoie, so when the team cut ties with Lajoie after the 1914 season, it was in the market for a new name. Club officials and sports writers agreed on Indians in January 1915. The Boston Braves' miraculous World Series triumph may have been part of the inspiration behind Cleveland's new moniker. The Colorado Rockies. When team officials announced that Denver's expansion team would begin play in 1993 as the Colorado Rockies, some fans couldn't help but question why the team was adopting the same nickname as the city's former NHL franchise, which averaged an abysmal 19 wins per season from 1976 to 1982. I think for us to compare a failed hockey franchise 10 years ago is nonsense. Rockies CEO John Antonucci said, "We feel very strongly the Colorado Rockies might be one of the strongest names in all of professional sports." According to surveys conducted by Denver's daily newspapers, fans preferred the nickname Bears, which had been used by Denver's most famous minor league team. "The name we picked, it's strong, enduring, majestic," Antonucci said. Detroit Tigers. Detroit's original minor league baseball team was officially known as the Wolverines. The club was also referred to as the Tigers, the nickname for the members of Michigan's oldest military unit, the 425th National Guard Infantry Regiment, which fought in the Civil War and Spanish-American War. When Detroit joined the newly formed American League in 1901, the team received formal permission from the regiment, which was known as the Detroit Light Guard, to use its symbol and nickname. Miami Marlins. The Marlins take their name from the minor league Miami Marlins that called South Florida home from 1956 to 1960, 1962 to 1970, and 1972 to 1988. Owner Wayne Huizenga hoped to give his expansion team, which entered the league in 1993, more regional appeal by including Florida in the name. However, when the Marlins moved into their new baseball-only stadium in 2012, they became the Miami Marlins. The Houston Astros. Houston's baseball team was originally known as the Colt 45s, but team president Judge Roy Hofheinz made a change in keeping with the times in 1965. Citing Houston's status as the space age capital of the world, Hofheinz settled on Astros. With our new dome stadium, we think it will also make Houston the sports capital of the world, Hofheinz said. The change was likely also motivated by pressure from the Colt Firearms Company, which also objected to the use of the Colt 45 nickname. Kansas City Royals. When Kansas City was awarded an expansion franchise in 1969, club officials chose Royals from more than 17,000 entries in a Name the Team contest. Sanford Port, one of 547 fans who submitted Royals, was awarded an all-expense-paid trip to the All-Star Game. Port submitted the name because of Kansas City's position as the nation's leading stocker and feeder market and the nationally known American Royal Livestock and Horse Show. Royalty stands for the best. That's another reason. Coincidentally, Kansas City's Negro League team was nicknamed the Monarchs. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Los Angeles gained a second major league team in 1961, then the Los Angeles Angels entered the American League. The nickname had been used by Los Angeles Pacific Coast League team from 1903 to 1957. The team was renamed the California Angels in 1965 and became the Anaheim Angels after the Walt Disney Company took control of the team in 1997. While the team's lease with the city requires that Anaheim be part of the team's name, owner Artie Moreno changed the team's name to include Los Angeles in 2005 in hopes of tapping into the L.A. media market. The result is one of the most absurd names in all of professional sports. The Los Angeles Dodgers. The Dodgers traced their roots to Brooklyn, where the team was known as the Bridegrooms, the Superbas, and beginning in 1911, the Trolley Dodgers. The Dodgers' nickname referenced the pedestrians who dodged the trolleys that carried passengers through the streets of Brooklyn. While the team was known as the Robins from 1914 to 1931, in honor of the legendary manager Wilbert Robinson, Uncle Robbie, the nickname switched back to Dodgers when Robinson retired. When Walter O'Malley moved the franchise to Los Angeles after the 1957 season, he elected to keep the name. Milwaukee Brewers. The Brewers' nickname, a nod to Milwaukee's beer industry, was used off and on by various Milwaukee baseball teams during the late 19th century. When the expansion Seattle Pilots relocated to Milwaukee after one failed season in 1969, the team adopted the traditional Brewers nickname under the ownership of Bud Selig. Minnesota Twins. Minneapolis and St. Paul, which are separated by the Mississippi River and collectively known as the Twin Cities, argued for years over where an expansion team in Minnesota, should one arrive, would call home. When the Washington Senators moved to Minneapolis in 1961, club officials settled on Twins as the team nickname and unveiled an emblem showing two baseball players with hands clasped in front of a huge baseball. The New York Mets. Team officials asked fans to choose a nickname from among 10 finalists when New York was awarded an expansion National League franchise in 1961. The finalists were Avengers, Bees, Burrows, Continentals, Jets, Mets, NYBS. Yeah. It's true. Rebels, Skyliners, and Skyscrapers. The team received 2,563 mailed entries, which include 9,613 suggestions and 644 different names. Mets was the resounding winner, followed by two nicknames that weren't among the team's 10 suggestions, Empires and Islanders. As the New York Times noted, what the fans will call the team when it begins play, of course, will depend in part on how it performs. One of the reasons the team officials chose Mets was because it has a brevity that will delight headline writers. Another reason was the nickname's Historical Baseball Association. The New York Metropolitans, often called the Mets, played in the American Association from 1883 to 1888. The New York Yankees. In 1903, the original Baltimore Orioles moved to New York, where they became the Highlanders. As was common at the time, the team which played in the American League was also known as the New York Americans. New York Press editor Jim Price coined the nickname Yanks or Yankees in 1904 because it was easier to fit in headlines. The Oakland Athletics. The Athletics' nickname is one of the oldest in baseball, dating to the early 1860s and the Athletic Baseball Club of Philadelphia. In 1902, New York Giants manager John McGraw referred to Philadelphia's American League team as a white elephant. The slight was picked up by a reporter in Philadelphia, and the white elephant was adopted as the team's primary logo. The nickname and the elephant logo were retained when the team moved to Kansas City in 1955 and to Oakland in 1968. The Philadelphia Phillies, founded in 1883 as the Quakers, the franchise changed its nickname to Philadelphia's, which soon became Phillies. New owner Robert Carpenter held a contest to rename the team in 1943, and Blue Jays was selected as the winner. While the team wore a Blue Jay patch on its uniform for a couple of seasons, the nickname failed to catch on. The Pittsburgh Pirates. After the Players League collapsed in 1890, the National League's Pittsburgh club signed two players, including Lou Bierbauer, who the Philadelphia Athletics forgot to place on their reserve list. A Philadelphia sports writer claimed that Pittsburgh pirated away Bierbauer, and the Pirates' nickname was born. San Diego Padres. When San Diego was awarded an expansion team in 1969, the club adopted the nickname of the city's Pacific Coast League team, the Padres. The nickname, which is Spanish for father or priest, was a reference to San Diego's status as the first Spanish mission in California. The San Francisco Giants. The New York Giants moved to San Francisco in 1957 and retained their nickname, which dates back to 1885. It was during that season, according to legend, that the New York Gothams manager Jim Mutrie referred to his players as his Giants after a rousing win over Philadelphia. Seattle Mariners. Mariners was the winning entry among more than 600 suggestions in a Name the Team contest for Seattle's expansion franchise in 1976. Multiple fans submitted the nickname Mariners, but the team determined that Roger Smotis of Bellevue provided the best reason. I've selected Mariners because of the natural association between the sea and Seattle and her people, who have been challenged and rewarded by it, said Smotis, who received two season tickets and an all-expense-paid trip to an American League city on the West Coast. St. Louis Cardinals. In 1899, the St. Louis Browns became the St. Louis Perfectos. That season, Willie McHale, a columnist for the St. Louis Republic, reportedly heard a woman refer to the team's red stockings as a lovely shade of cardinal. McHale included the nickname in his column, and it was an instant hit among fans. The team officially changed its nickname in 1900. The Tampa Bay Rays. Vince Nimoli, owner of Tampa Bay's expansion team, chose Devil Rays out of more than 7,000 suggestions submitted by the public in 1995. The reason was not positive. The reaction was not positive. So far, I've fielded about 20 phone calls protesting Devil Rays, and most of the callers have described themselves as Christians who are upset about the word devil, a Tampa Tribune columnist told a reporter less than a week after the nickname was announced. Nimoli reportedly wanted to nickname his team the Stingrays, but it was trademarked by a team in the Hawaiian Winter League. The team dropped the devil after the 2007 season, and the curse that had plagued the franchise for the previous decade was apparently lifted as Tampa Bay made a surprising run to the World Series the following season. Texas Rangers. A second franchise named the Senators left Washington in 1972. this time for Arlington, Texas. Owner Robert Short renamed the team the Rangers after the Texas Law Enforcement Agency that was formed under Stephen F. Austin in the 1820s. Toronto Blue Jays. More than 30,000 entries were received during a five-week Name the Team contest. A panel of 14 judges, including 10 Toronto media members, selected 10 finalists. From that list, the club's board of directors settled on Blue Jays. The Blue Jays was felt to be the most appropriate of the final 10 names submitted, according to a statement issued by the board's chairman, R. Howard Webster. The blue jay is a North American bird, bright in blue color, with white undercovering and a black neck ring. It is strong, aggressive, and inquisitive. It dares to take on all comers, yet is down to earth, gutsy, and good looking. Yeehaw. The Washington Nationals. Washington's original baseball team was interchangeably referred to as the Senators and Nationals, or Nats for short, for most of its time in the district before relocating to Minnesota in 1960. Washington's 1961 expansion franchise was known almost exclusively as the Senators until it moved to Texas after the 1971 season. When the Montreal Expos relocated to the nation's capital in 2005, the team revived the Nationals' nickname. So that's the story of how all 30 Major League Baseball teams received their nicknames. Pretty interesting. Taking a look at the New York Rangers, well, in the third period, the Rangers lead the Washington Capitals 4-1 at the Verizon Center in Washington. So that game looks to be pretty much out of the reach of the Washington Capitals. And it looks like Tommy Lasorda will not be joining us tonight. We'll have to take that matter up with his assistant tomorrow morning out in Los Angeles and see what the problem was with Mr. Lasorda. He might have gone on a rampage about Dave Kingman again. I'm not sure what happened, but we'll make sure to take that up. I apologize to all you folks who tuned in tonight expecting to hear Tommy Lasorda. We'll try to bring him to you during a show in the future. But I believe we'll take a break right now. We'll be back with Benji Molina, former Major League backstop, discussing his new book, Molina, right after this. Stay tuned.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA, or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through this Sunday evening, this Mother's Day Sunday evening. Once again, happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. As Ralph Kiner used to say, I'll paraphrase, to all the mothers out there, happy birthday. We'll take a look at the New York Rangers score. Let's see what's happening down in Washington. Still, the Caps are on their way back. It's in the third period, Rangers leading 4-2. So hopefully Washington will come back and do some damage here. I'm not a Ranger fan, no. So my next guest, though, let's get to him. My next guest, two-time Gold Glove winner and a World Series champion in 2002 with the Anaheim Angels. He's the older brother of fellow Major League catchers Jose and Yadier. His new book is titled Molina, the story of a father who raised an unlikely baseball dynasty. He will be at Barnes & Noble on Warren Street in Tribeca at 6 o'clock this Tuesday night, May 12th. He'll be in conversation with his co-author, Joan Ryan. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Benji Molina. Benji, good evening.
Good evening, guys, and thank you for having me, for sure. This is an honor for me to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you, Benji. I'd just like to start off asking you, you grew up in Puerto Rico. Who were your favorite ball players and any favorite teams that you rooted for when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I was growing up idolizing Roberto Clemente, obviously.
Uh-huh.
And not only for the baseball side, but only for his human side. You know, he was a very good human being, and he always tried to help anybody that he could, so and that caught my attention. But I follow really close Pete Rose because he was 110% hustle.
Right.
And that's the way I wanted to always play the game. So I follow those two players, but my team was the Pittsburgh Pirates. I love when Clemente played there.
Great. Okay, now In 2000 is when you really broke in. You were fourth in the Rookie of the Year voting with the Angels. You played for Mike Socia. How was he as a skipper?
He was, tell you the truth, he was one of the best, if not the best, manager I ever played with. And not only that, he's a good friend, a very good friend. He took me under his wing. He taught me about tricks about calling a game. He taught me about made it easy for me to call the game. He taught me about the game itself, hitting. He taught me everything that I know came from that guy when I got to the big leagues. I owe him a lot. So he was not only a good manager or the best manager, but he was a good friend.
Exactly. I can imagine. Now, also a catcher. Did he teach you, was he able to lend you some expertise behind the plate?
Exactly, yes. Every single day. First spring training I had with him, I had to tell him every inning what I threw to every single hitter, every single pitch. Mm-hmm. First one to the last one, I had to tell him what I call and why. And that what that does was he said that, he keep me in the game for next at-bat for the same batter so I don't make the same mistakes, you know, things like that. So he took me under his wing, man. I owe him a lot of my career.
Excellent. Okay. Now, over your last few seasons with the Angels, your brother Jose was your backup. Now, how was that playing with Jose?
Playing with Jose was a dream come true for me. It was very exciting, very, very, I always call it educational, because all we did was go to the mall, go to Panda Express, have lunch, and go to the field together for 4 years. We did that every single day, but talking about the 2002 when we won, if I didn't have him on my side, I don't think we win, because we study so much together and we were a partner together, and that's what made it work. So having him was a dream come true for me, for sure.
Beautiful. We're speaking with Benji Molina tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, after 2005, Benji, your contract expired with Anaheim. You signed a one-year deal with the Toronto Blue Jays. You were disappointed with leaving the Angels. Talk about that.
Well, I was very disappointed because I thought they would appreciate the years that I was there, you know. So I was very disappointed when they let me go, especially for somebody that didn't even have half of my numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought about being loyal. So I thought they were going to be loyal to me.
Right.
But hard enough, the baseball is not a loyalty, necessarily loyal, you know. So I learned the hard way, and it was very disappointing. I had a three-year deal with the Mets on the line before my former agent messed it up for me.
Oh, I remember that now. Yeah, yeah. We wanted you here. That's right. Yeah.
And I have already said yes. I want to come over, and I told him I want to come over. It was a three-year deal. It was going to get me, you know, through my life okay. It was going to be great. So I told him yes, and all of a sudden, a week later, I heard that the Mets got Polo Duca. Well, then when I talked to my lawyer, he told me, oh, you don't want to go there anyway. I'm like, dude, I'm telling you, you work for me.
Yeah.
I told you I want to go there. What is your problem? So he was something that got messed up, and that was the deal. But then I ended up signing with Toronto.
Right.
1 week before spring training was over. I mean, started. I'm sorry. 1 week I started. It was very frustrating. I felt like nobody wanted me. I felt like I didn't deserve or I didn't play good enough to have a free agency, you know.
Right.
So I felt really bad. But I had a great year in Toronto.
Now, you platooned with Zahn. Did that disappoint you that Gibbons platooned you with Greg Zahn?
Very much.
Yeah.
Very much. I was very upset about that. I didn't appreciate it. Nothing against Greg Zahn, of course, but that was the way the manager saw it, and that's the way he was going to go about mm-hmm. it. And, no, I thought I deserved to play more. I obviously had way better numbers and all that if he wanted to go there, you know. I don't know. But he felt like we needed a platoon, and that messed me up big time because I only ended up playing like 93 games and cut like 80 or something like that.
Right.
So if I had a little bit more games, I probably had a little bit better numbers than I already did. So I was very disappointed. But you know what? God is being always good to me in baseball, and he saw that I was struggling a little bit. I had a good season with the Angels, and nothing happened. And then I go back to Toronto and have a great year, also one of my best years. And San Francisco saw me.
Right.
I signed there for 3 years. It was awesome.
It looked like you really enjoyed it in San Francisco. You like you said, you went out there for 3 years, you re-signed for one, and you got to play for Bruce Bochy.
Yes, one of the best guys I ever met.
Another catcher.
Another catcher and one of the best human beings I ever met. He was an unbelievable person. He always called me Big Kahuna. He said, hey, Big Kahuna, what are you doing? How are you feeling today, buddy? You ready to catch for me? You know, things like that. It was awesome. Playing there for San Francisco was awesome. One of the most beautiful cities in the world. I think it was unbelievable. I had a chance to catch Lincecum, Matt Cain, and all those guys over there. It was very nice over there for me, seriously. I didn't want to leave San Francisco, but some kid came in. I don't know what kind of rookie. I don't know who they got. And some kid came in. I don't know even his name. Do you know Buster Posey?
Yeah, some kid named Buster Posey they brought in.
I don't know who that is. You know, Buster Posey, who's that? Is that like an MVP or something?
He had a little bit of success. Yeah.
Oh, okay,
little,
okay,
yeah,
okay.
He had a little minor success. I want to read some quotes though from some of the guys. Tim Lincecum had something to say about Benji Molina's contributions. He said he helped me mature and succeed. I've said time and time again that he deserves half of those awards that I've gotten. said Tim Lincecum, the reigning two-time National League Cy Young Award winner. That's Tim Lincecum. And Matt Cain, the things he's done for me, calling a game to give me confidence, throwing different pitches and different counts, really, really benefited me. That's what Matt Cain said of Benji Molina. So there's some of the accomplishments that Benji Molina left behind when he left San Francisco.
Yeah, I always put them before me. It was very easy for me to. I always wanted them to have a very good career and have a very good family, have a very good money to support their family. I always wanted them to be great, you know, before me. And that's why I sacrificed everything for them.
Right. Now, you went to Texas. How did you enjoy it going to Texas?
I was very frustrating when I left
right. The
Giants because I didn't want to leave. But when I got to Texas, it was very fun. A lot of the guys that I had there, they were very, very fun. They enjoyed the game. It was very different from San Francisco and the places I've been. They were more like a serious, you know, type deal. You got to win and that's it, you know. But here, for some reason, I felt like they were just having fun out there, you know, on the field, and they weren't afraid of showing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in. I joined in, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed my time. I guess it was like 3 months. I'm not sure, but I enjoyed my time there. I really did, and I loved that. I loved that atmosphere of baseball. So for me, going to Texas, and then we made it to the World Series.
Right,
it wasn't bad either.
You made it to the World Series. Well, either way, the fans might remember this. Either way, you were going to make it to the World Series because you were on the Giant. You were going to get a ring either way because the Giants were going for the series. The Rangers were going for the series. So Benji was going to get a ring no matter what, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I did. Thank God I did.
Yeah. So he got his ring with Anaheim. He got his ring with Texas, and you hit a home run in the what was it, the ALCS against AJ Burnett. You remember that one?
Yes, I do, and I really do feel bad for him because he's a good friend of mine. When I was in Toronto, I caught him too. But you know, once you're in the business, I'm sure he wanted to strike me out. You know?
Yeah.
So when I hit that, I tell you. It was just happiness because I started off hot that year. I was hitting like 400 in the first month or something like that, and then I got hit on the elbow catching, and my elbow was a chip fracture. I don't know how to call that, but it was like kind of chipped up, and it was sore swinging the bat, so I started going down from that day on. I couldn't hit, but I was still catching because they needed me catching, so... And it was bad, you know. So when I got to Texas, I felt like I never had a strong, you know, I wasn't strong enough. And when that homer came on, you know, it's like gave me confidence that I can do it again, you know.
Definitely. Now, that was the end of the road for you in Texas.
Yes.
Did you want to hang it up then, or did you want to keep going?
I wanted to keep going one more year, but all I had, to tell you the truth, was like 3 or 4 minor league deals, which I thought it was very insulting for me.
Yeah.
After I've done so good and I was good in so many aspects of the game. I've been doing my job all those years, and all of a sudden all I get was 3 minor league deals. I mean, I was very upset. I was very frustrated. I was very sad. I was very disappointed at the baseball. And I said, you know what? My family deserved me. I want to be with my family,
mm-hmm.
and that's it, you know, so I decided to do that.
So you stayed in as a coach?
Well, I spent 2 years off from baseball. I didn't even watch a game, I think.
No, yeah.
And then Yadi came on with the idea of me coaching with the St. Louis Cardinals in 2013. So I went over, I accepted the job, and I went over and I had one of the best times of my life. We went to the World Series, ended up losing to Boston. But for me, it was one of the best ever, years ever, because I spent it with my brother in the World Series.
That was a great series, too.
Yeah,
that was really
an awesome series.
Yeah.
I thought we were going to win for sure, but We got cold a little bit.
Now, getting to the book. The book is called Molina, The Story of a Father Who Raised an Unlikely Baseball Dynasty, about the Molina boys. When you were signed, you started as a shortstop.
Yes.
When you were signed, it was as a catcher, the one position you never played. why didn't you ever catch up until that time, and was it hard learning the position you never played before?
Well, I can tell you this. When I was growing up playing for my dad in little leagues, it was very tough because I was very skinny. I couldn't lift the bat too good. The bats were very heavy for me, so I couldn't hit. I was very skinny. And in Puerto Rico, for some reason, whoever was bigger, like a bigger size kid, they put him to catch. For some reason at that time, that's what they were doing. So, like my two brothers, they were always like bigger size, tall, and they were a little bigger than the other kids. So they were catchers all their life. But when me being so skinny, my dad took advantage of that, and I was very fast. And my dad put me in center, first base, third base, everywhere. He needed me, my dad put me to play. So that's how it started. And then one day, my mom, my brother, Jose, was getting a tryout for the Angels to see if the Angels draft him.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother was reading a paper. I came out. I was playing amateur ball, and I went 4-for-5, 2 doubles, 2 triples. So I came up in a little paper, newspaper in Puerto Rico. And then my mom was, she didn't know any English. So he went to the scout, Ray Poinovic, and she said, my son, you have to see my son.
Yeah.
And the guy saw her, and he didn't know what she was saying. And she said it. She said, my son, I want you to see my son. And somebody translate for her, and the guy said, all right, let me see him.
Right, your mother got you the tryout.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. If it wasn't for her, we wouldn't be talking here right now.
Yeah.
So she told him that, and the guy said, I want to see him. So my brother went over and got me, and when we started warming up with my dad and my brother, I had an outfield glove. I had an infield glove. I never had a catcher's glove because I never caught in my life. So, and the guy saw me and gave me a catcher's glove. And he said, hey, are you ready? Come here. Here's a catcher's glove. Throw to second base. Let me see how you do. What? Really? I never even caught. So I look at my dad, and my dad said, hey, man, what do you scare about? Because your brother's a catcher. You know what they do. Catch and throw the ball.
Right.
So I said, all right, catch and throw. That's what I'm going to do. And I threw the second base, and I guess I did pretty good. He signed me, and $1,000 later, I was on my way to that was a Saturday. Tuesday, I was on my way to rookie ball to play catcher. That's how my catching career started.
And the rest, they say, is history.
The rest, they say, is history, man.
Yeah. We're talking to Benji Molina tonight. He's going to be downtown. Warren Street, Tribeca, Barnes & Noble on Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, signing his book. And you should go down there and meet the man, because it's a very inspiring story. Now, you say being a catcher is as much about stamina and pain tolerance as it is about skill and strategy. Catchers don't complain. What to you is a catcher's mentality, Benji?
Well, the catcher's mentality means to me a lot more than that. You know, obviously it's kind of hard to explain. You have to be very, very, very strong mentally. You have to be able to erase some bad things, sometimes even good things. You have to be able to tolerate getting hit 6 times a game. You have to be able to be a psychiatrist with your pitchers. You have to be able to be a cheerleader. But at the same time, you have to be able to be a strong man, a father figure, a leader, a guy who is going to take charge, a guy who sees the other team like your son, a guy who sees everybody, you know what I mean, like help people and have a positive attitude. If somebody is going down and you are going down, no, have the best positive attitude, things like that. You know, you have to be so much as a catcher. And that, for me, is mentality, you know, catcher's mentality. You have to be a leader out there.
Definitely. Now, just as your career as a baseball player was taking off, your marriage was having some trouble. How did one impact the other?
For me, when I was going through that little rough time in my life, it impacted in baseball because it taught me many things. At the same time, like, baseball is a game of failure. Well, I was failing at the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So what baseball always taught me was you have to bounce back. You have to bounce back somehow. You have to be a better player. When something goes wrong, you have to stay strong if you want to survive in baseball. Well, kind of life, I took it that way. I took it the same way. I said, you know what, I'm going really on a hard time here, but I'm going to take it in the positive way. I'm going to be the guy that's going to say, okay, he's going through a divorce, a hard divorce, but guess what? I'm going to bounce back, and I'm going to be the best person I can.
That's a great way to look at it, Benji, for sure. Now, Jose's first year in baseball was a backup catcher to you. As we said, you both play for Anaheim. Has there ever been any jealousy among you guys, or do you share your success? And how does the attitude been a credit to the way you guys were raised?
You know what? We never – the way our dad always raised us and my mom, and she never – they never taught us to hate on each other, to be jealous of anybody. We have what we have, and we were very happy and excited for it. So with that being said, I think the way we were raised, we never fought about being better than the other guy. We never saw that. We were always very realistic family. And in this moment that Jose went in and he saw me, he knew that I was a number one guy and he was a number two. So he embraced that moment of being a backup player, and that's what he was. He didn't try to be the number one, and I didn't try to be a backup. So it was never a misunderstanding, or it was never a jealousy or anything of that kind.
Outstanding, yeah. Now, to win the 2002 series with Jose by your side, that must have been extra special.
It was... it's hard to put it in words, and you understand. For me, it was a very, very special moment, a very, 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 very exciting moment, very special, very exciting. When that ball went up, it was a funny story behind that. When we were in the eighth inning and we were hitting, I told my brother, I said, hey, listen, if we win these three games, if we do these three outs and we win, please don't go to me right away because all the cameras are going to be in us and we're going to be crying, you know. So I told him, don't come to me, man. Please, go the other way. And then, oh, yeah, bro, don't worry. I'm not going to go to you. I'm going to go somewhere else. That fly ball was caught by Darren Erstad, and I hugged Percy. When I hit my feet on the ground, the first guy I saw was my brother.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, oh, what are you doing? So we started crying, and I told you to stay away, man. But no, it was a very special moment, and it forever will be in my heart until the day I die.
Now, part of your motivation growing up was to fulfill your father's dream of playing in the bigs. Now, it wasn't until after he died that you learned that wasn't his dream at all. What was it like to finally learn that your father never tried out for the major leagues? And what would you say to him at that point?
You know what? It's kind of weird. when I first noticed and learned that wasn't his dream. His dream was his family, take care of his brothers and sister. And his dream was about taking care of a family. You know, like in that moment, my mom was pregnant with me, and he had a chance to be in a tryout. And he thought he had a chance because he was fast. He was a very good hitter.
Mm-hmm.
But in the moment, he's thinking about leaving my mom pregnant, you know, and going to practice or going to a spring training or something like that. So he chose family over professional baseball team. But I didn't know that, obviously, until later when he passed away and everybody kept telling me he lived his life. He lived what he wanted to do. And I always ask, it's like, what do you mean by that? What do you mean? And he always said, I live my life. I have my family. I fulfill my dream. I'm taking care of my family, you know, and that's why it matters. He always cared about the family, and that was what he really wanted. And if I ever, I always tell God, I'll give everything back just to see him one more time. I don't care how much money or cars or material things I have. I don't give a crap. I give him everything back if I could see him one more time and I can hug him and talk to him.
Yeah.
And I would tell him how much I love him and how much I wish he was here with us.
Yeah. And that was the dream.
Yes.
Now, you finished the book, Benji. We're speaking to Benji Molina tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You conclude your book by saying, through baseball, your father taught all of you, you guys, Jose, Yachty, yourself, how to be men. What does that mean to you, Benji?
oh, man. That means the world to me. He taught us everything we knew. And people think he only taught us baseball. But no, he taught us how to live life, how to be a man, how to be a good Christian man, a very nice people, helping others, take care of the school, take care of everything through baseball. I tell you this, my dad had three sons. Yes, everybody knows us. For me and for my brothers, my dad is the Hall of Famer. And not only that, for me, in my heart, my dad didn't have three kids. My dad had thousands and thousands of kids that he was the coach to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think he was a father figure to so many kids after we left. He was still a coach. He was still going through games. He was still going through practice like this. He did it with us. So I don't think he had three sons like everybody thinks. I think he had thousands and thousands of kids like us as sons.
Amazing. Outstanding. Well, Benji, I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. The new book is called Molina, The Story of the Father Who Raised an Unlikely Baseball Dynasty. Benji will be at Barnes & Noble, downtown Manhattan, Warren Street in Tribeca this Tuesday night, May the 12th at 6 p.m. He'll be in conversation with his co-author, Joan Ryan. Please go down there, say hi. Thanks for being with us tonight, Benji.
And thank you, guys. And for real, the book is about sharing a story that a lot of people are hopefully get motivated to try to make it just the same way as we did. And that's what we want from the book, is just to share a story of a great dad.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care, Benji. All the best.
Thank you so much.
Benji Molina, folks. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, the great Carl Erskine, Jim Cott, Benji Molina, and thank you for joining us. I'll be back with you Sunday, May 24th, with former heavyweight champ Larry Holmes and former Major League catcher Charlie O'Brien. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
In the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.